Welcome back to the program. What happens when the largest retailer in the world decides that it's going to go green? What happens when suddenly a company the size of Walmart realizes that it can do well economically by doing good? It's a radical change, and it may have dramatic impacts on retailers and businesses throughout the world. We're going to talk about that today with my guest, Edward Hume. He's been on this program before. He's the author of 10 critically acclaimed nonfiction books, including Eco Barons, Monkey Girl, School of Dreams. It is my pleasure to welcome him back to this program to talk about his newest work, Force of Nature, the unlikely story of Walmart's green revolution. Edward Hume, thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure, Jeff.
Great to have you here. The idea that Walmart would become one of the greenest companies in the country is almost hard to get one's head around.
No kidding. I have to say I was a bit skeptical about it myself, but the hard data is there. They have found that there is a strong business case for green. And, you know, Walmart is all about enhancing its bottom line, and it turns out that there's a lot of things you can do that are profit and planet friendly at the same time, and they've been doing it now for 6-7 years.
One of the things that is so remarkable is how this all got started, that it wasn't, you know, a bunch of guys sitting around a corporate boardroom at first deciding we were going to do this, but really the relationship between Lee Scott, who was then the CEO of Walmart, and an interesting character named Jib Ellison.
Yeah, Jib Ellison actually lives in your area, and he came up as a young river guy who did these wild whitewater rafting expeditions all over the world. He was one of the first Westerners allowed to go rafting in Siberia during the Cold War, and he actually was bringing together these crews, citizen diplomats of Americans and Soviets during the Cold War. It was a very cool program, and he learned a lot doing that, and he got into the world of business leadership consulting. And using the lessons learned on the rivers, bringing very diverse people together into the business world. And very successful at that. And then wanted to introduce an environmental component back to his work because he had spent so much of his time out in nature, and his first client on that score was Walmart. And he brought a very different sensibility to that company and said, you are missing the biggest business opportunity of the 21st century, which is sustainability. And all the things you think you're being lean and mean at economically, if you would only look at them with a different lens, a greener lens, you would find new opportunities. And they said, well, prove it. And that's what they set out to do.
And how did he and Lee Scott get together?
Well, Jib Ellison had left his partners. He had tried to urge them in his original consultancy to make green the center of their business, and they, at that time in 2004, that seemed like a risky proposition. And they said, you know, we don't think we want to fool around with success. So he struck out on his own, and he wrangled a meeting through his connections with Lee Scott, who at that time, 2004, Walmart's brand image, its reputation, was really hurting. They were losing business, according to their own internal studies. As many as 8% of their customer base was saying Walmart's reputation is so bad on labor, on gender, on sweatshops. There'd been one awful news story after another. Raids from customs services arresting illegals being employed as contractors in Walmart. It was a drumbeat of negativity. And Lee Scott was looking to get out in front of environmental problems that were just starting to rear their head for construction of new stores, and the footprint of the company was beginning to be criticized. So he was talking to people about what they could do to kind of defend, be proactive on the environment, and keep at least that part of the criticism at bay. And that's how he took the meeting with Jib Ellison. But a funny thing happened when they started seeing that doing some things with their supply chain, with packaging, with waste that was much greener, was also making them more money. It stopped being about good PR, and it stopped being about improving the image of the company, and it started being about improving the bottom line of the company. And there's just a ton of examples of how that was proved time and again.
Now, you mentioned packaging. That was really the area where it started. That's where this enterprise kind of began.
Yeah, with a toy truck. Very humble beginning was one of the early experiments. And they sell, you know, Walmart, it's huge, right? They sell a single toy truck by the millions. It's made in China. It's plastic. Comes in a cardboard box. And you've seen these boxes, right? It's designed to display the toy. The kids can reach in and push a button and make something happen. And the packages are a lot bigger than the actual things they're containing. So the idea was, what if we shrink that package a little bit? What'll happen? And so they did. They just took a couple inches off this toy truck package, just a test. And the first thing they noticed, well, we saved 4,000 trees. You know, what a nice thing for the planet. But then you dig deeper and you find out, well, okay, the smaller packages take up less room when we ship them. Turns out 497 fewer shipping containers, those giant things that go on cargo vessels, 497 fewer. They saved 1 million barrels of oil by the time you're done shipping all those cargo containers and truckloads around the world and the country to deliver them. They ultimately found that they saved, from that one packaging change, a couple inches, $2.5 million in a year. Now, they'd have to sell $60 million worth of those toys to make that much in profit. So that got their attention. They said, wow, we're doing something good for the planet, and we're really helping our bottom line. One product. What happens if we start looking at everything? And this rhetoric that their river guide had given them, that you're missing a big opportunity by thinking of green as a cost or as a burden, when you really need to be thinking of it as an opportunity, that really sunk in with that toy truck.
What kind of resistance was there initially inside Walmart? Obviously, this wasn't something that every board member or everybody inside the company was quick to jump on.
No, not at all. Well, it's such a, you know, you talk about the skepticism on the outside about, well, how could a company like Walmart be interested in being greener? There was skepticism on the inside that this, we're so conditioned, particularly in the business community, particularly corporate leaders. You hear environment, and the first thing you want to do is shove it off to somebody else's, some underling's bailiwick, you know, because it's regulation, it's cost, it's risk, it's all the things that leaders of companies wish they didn't have to deal with. That's how the world of business circa 2004 was thinking about the environment. And now you have this guy, who spent half his life sleeping by a riverbank somewhere, telling you, no, you got it all wrong, that stop thinking about environmentalism as a burden and start looking at your product lines and your supply chain and saying, if we make this greener, it's going to let us hold on to more of our money or make money. And that was a very tough idea. The other tough thing that Walmart employees and staff and leaders had to accept was the need to bring in outsiders. They had this thing they called the Bentonville bubble at the headquarters for Walmart, where, you know, you just live in your own little world, the Walmart world, and it's very hard to get fresh thinking in there. I mean, they feel like they know what's best about their business, and in many cases they do. But suddenly, their consultant was bringing in the head of the NRDC and the former president of the Sierra Club, who, you know, once called Walmart the devil, and having them contributing their views to how Walmart could be greener and more profitable at the same time. And what they found, though, was that those fresh eyes really helped them see some of these opportunities. And so that former head of the Sierra Club, who, you know, was a Walmart critic, ended up creating this program to teach 1 million Walmart employees how to be greener in their personal lives. Remarkable.
Also, Walmart, because of its sheer size and because of its scale, had the power and the ability to push these changes all the way down the supply chain.
Well, and that's where I think what made this story so attractive to me, because the idea of the biggest retailing operation on the planet, which can never be truly green in its entirety. I mean, they're outsourced. Their model is based upon getting people to buy more stuff. I mean, that's not a very sustainable business model. And yet, they're trying to be better. They're trying to be less bad and succeeding in some cases spectacularly. And then saying, well, you know, the real footprint we have on the planet isn't so much inside our stores or inside our trucks. That's important, but 90% of our footprint in the world comes from the stuff we sell and from the people who make them and bring them to us and sell them in, on our shelves. So we need to take these ideas to our suppliers. So the new message from Walmart started to be, well, we want things to be inexpensive for our customers, but we also want them to be greener. And there was a carrot and a stick. You know, you do what we're asking you to do. We'll treat you well. We'll give you good display. You don't do it, well, maybe you won't be on our shelves anymore, so which is not a threat that a lot of companies want to hear. If you make detergent, laundry detergent, and the company that sells a fourth of the billion bottles of liquid laundry detergent that are sold every year in the world tells you, you better start shipping us greener, smaller bottles or we're not going to sell your laundry soap anymore, you listen. They single-handedly, Walmart, altered the structure of the detergent industry. That's why we all have smaller bottles instead of those big jumbo ones that used to be the preferred laundry detergent. And that has saved millions of dollars, hundreds of millions of gallons of water, 95 million tons of plastic a year for those laundry bottles that now are smaller. I mean, the impact of those kinds of supply chain changes is almost incalculable because there's such a ripple effect, because it's not just the detergent that gets shipped to Walmart. It's all the detergent now is more eco-friendly because of that one decision.
How did they impose this on some of their factories and suppliers in China?
Well, that's a fascinating piece. I mean, if Walmart was a country, it would be the sixth or seventh largest trading partner for China. I mean, something just out of this world. They do a lot of business with China. And outsourcing, of course, is one of the things that we're grappling with as an environmental negative. One thing that they have tried to do, though, is something they started doing here in the U.S., and that's sending teams. They're working with the Environmental Defense Fund organization in China into these factories and making some recommendations on how to become more energy efficient. And the result of that is anywhere between a 20 to 30% reduction in the factories they've been working at in China, some of their leading suppliers. And that reduction is both in energy consumption and in carbon emissions. And that's huge. I mean, we're talking about, you know, a fourth to a third reduction in energy use, fossil fuel burning, and related carbon emissions. That's a huge gain. And it's not crazy, radical, expensive changes. It's more efficient and better maintained electric motors. It's more energy efficient lighting. The kinds of changes that pay for themselves in a very short time, 6 months to a year, you pay for that, and then your manufacturing costs remain lower than they were before. So Walmart gains because now they can get their products not only greener, but cheaper.
Right.
They did this in the U.S. They pioneered this. They sent energy auditors to it's a different companies. One of the first ones was an underwear maker in the South called Dana's Undies. And they saw their energy costs reduced from 50 to 70%, their electric bills. I mean, what business won't want to do that? It becomes a no-brainer to be greener by being more efficient, by conserving energy, and by making these kinds of changes to your business. And the only question that large and small business start asking is, why didn't we do this sooner?
One of the things that's so counterintuitive about this story, I suppose, is that you think of these things being done somewhere on a small scale, and then maybe working, figuring out what's more effective, and then scaling up. This is really the story of Walmart doing this on a gigantic scale, and then smaller enterprises learning from that.
I think that's true. I do think that there have been a number of smaller green enterprises that have influenced Walmart, the Patagonia company, for instance, which was whose leaders have been very critical of Walmart over the years, are now partnering with them and have been sharing their insights into how to make greener products and do business in a greener fashion. So the interesting thing about this process was that by opening a very secretive closed world company like Walmart to these outside influences, to actually putting their critics to work inside the company for free. What environmental organization would turn down the opportunity to come in and try and green Walmart? But by allowing that kind of influence into the company, it really changed the way they perceive green and environmentalism. And, you know, they talk about it being baked into the company now and how it influences a lot of their business decisions. They just had an investor meeting some months ago where this came up, and they said, you know, the ripple effect of this core change to our businesses has really carried over into health issues, into, you know, this new initiative they have to try to make healthier food less expensive at Walmart. They link that to sustainability too. It really has infected the company. It's like a good virus, I suppose,
right?
you could describe it. But it has to start at the top. That was one of the original messages that their Riverguide consultant brought to them, that if the CEO foists it off onto some sustainability officer who doesn't have the necessary clout in the company, it will never work. You will fail. You won't get the kind of gains either in helping the planet or in enhancing your profits that you will if, you know, the head hire fire guy is saying this is where we need to go. So that it was essential that it start big and then filter down through the ranks.
And is the current CEO of Walmart as committed to this as Lee Scott was before him?
He has said publicly that he feels that in the difficult economy, it's more important than ever to pursue this sustainability goal that they have set for themselves to become more sustainable and more green over time, because it does, as they're doing it, represent an enhancement to their bottom line. So even if sales are lagging or fuel prices are up, particularly if energy costs are going up, sustainability only makes more sense for them to pursue vigorously. So that's been his line in all his public statements. And, you know, they're just published their latest publicly available sustainability report, and they continue to make progress on some of the commitments they made to increase the sustainability of seafood. They've made their trucking fleet 65% more energy efficient than it was when they started this process. So I'd say that the new CEO, when he was still a vice president of the company, they had this program where they would send executives at Walmart out to the world to see the impact of Walmart. And Mike Duke, the current CEO's assignment was to go and stay in an ice hotel and visit a receding glacier out in northern Europe. And he did that, and he came back really shaken. And he's an engineer by training. He said, you know, this idea of global warming was just an academic question to me now, and now I feel very differently about it. So he's been a very strong advocate of taking action on global warming. Surprise, right?
How does all of this reconcile with the underlying business of Walmart, which is selling so much that is disposable?
Well, that is their challenge. How does a company that's historically always been about lowering the price, and one of the consequences of that tends to be, you know, cheaper goods don't last as long. How does Walmart become something that is more about consumer goods that last? And that's the challenge. I mean, they're actually talking about that. But that would be a long-term, very wrenching change for the company. But it's the kind of thing that the other thing they're talking about is, you know, right now, a lot of the green initiatives they're doing are for internal use because their customers aren't, their prime motivation for a Walmart customer tends not to be green. They like it. They would prefer it, but price is really guiding the buying choices of the majority of Walmart customers. They're not willing to pay a large premium for greener goods, as the customer base for seventh generation is, for instance.
Right.
So what do you do about that? Well, you just use that green data that they've been gathering on their packaging and their products internally, and you make your buying choices accordingly about what you put on the shelves, and just try and green everything to the extent that you can. And then you bide your time because what they believe is that the next generation of consumers is going to be guided by today's teenagers are the ones that are going to be driving green purchasing decisions. And they seem to believe that strongly. And they think that that's going to keep their business afloat because one thing they fear, and every retailer fears, is no major dominant retailing chain has ever continued its dominance across generations, whether it's A&P or Sears or you name it. They lose that dominant position when the next generation comes up. And so Walmart is positioning itself with these green initiatives for that future when they, their current customers' kids are making their buying decisions. So there is that long-term aspect to it, and that question of how do we become fundamentally more green is something for that, probably that more distant future.
And one of the things that they're working on as part of that distant future that you're right about for them and for other companies is this idea of the index. Talk a little about that.
Well, the idea is to find, I call it the origin story of what we consume, of what we buy, of all the products, because they are in large part black holes. You know, we know where our tube of toothpaste come from Colgate or from Crest or Aquafresh, whatever. But where does the stuff that is used to make the toothpaste and to make the tube come from? Not even the manufacturer can trace all of it back to its source. And that goes for every product, whether it's electronics or a lawnmower or whatever. The supply chain, if you go back to the origin and the source of the minerals or whatever that is in the product, we don't have a good handle on that. And therefore, it's almost impossible to calculate the true footprint of what we're buying, whether it's the greenhouse gas footprint or the water use footprint or the energy use footprint. And so Walmart has set out to change that dynamic and to fill the black hole with information. And they can't do that alone, so they have joined with other companies and academic institutions and environmental groups in this effort called the Sustainability Consortium. And they are crunching the data and putting together snapshots of whole categories and types of products that will reveal their footprint. And stage one of that is now underway. It's a monumental undertaking. And stage two is just starting, where that information is being used internally to influence buying and manufacturing decisions. Should we buy the socks from Company A and put them on our shelves, or the socks from Company B? Which ones are, well, of course, price is a consideration, but also which ones are using less energy? Which ones are emitting less carbon? Which ones have fewer toxins in their dyeing process? That's the kind of information that is now being assembled. And part three of that piece is to encapsulate that information for each product into a kind of a tag or a scannable barcode that consumers can use when they go to buy and shop. And that's the final piece of it, and the most difficult one, because there's going to be a score, and there's going to be winners and losers, and all these companies that are participating in are a little nervous about that,
right.
To say the least, because nobody wants to be the loser. But the feeling is that in the future, that kind of information is going to be very valuable to consumers. And there's already a segment of people who buy things that want that information. So that's what they're calling the index. And it has the potential to really make green and sustainability a market force as it never has been before.
Edward Hume, his book is Force of Nature, The Unlikely Story of Walmart's Green Revolution. Ed, I thank you so much for spending time with us.
It's always a pleasure, Jeff. Thank you.
Thank you.